case of today's docket is Teva Pharmaceuticals versus Weiser, and it's 24-1035, and we'll hear from Mr. Nelson.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. The Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause does not prohibit the taking of private property. The Takings Clause is designed to secure compensation if there is a taking. In other words, the Takings Clause provides a right to compensation. The Fifth Amendment does not require this compensation to precede the taking. All that it requires is that the property owner have some way to obtain compensation after the fact. This has been basic, fundamental takings clause doctrine for over 130 years. And this basic, fundamental doctrine also makes this case simple to resolve.
On the merits?
No, this is a jurisdictional question.
Well, I know it's a jurisdictional question, but whether or not the Teva Pharmaceuticals has a valid takings theory predicated on the adequacy or inadequacy of a state remedy, I understand what you just said, but why doesn't that pertain only to the validity of the claim on the merits rather than whether or not Teva Pharmaceuticals is seeking prospective injunctive relief, which is, I have always understood, as the first prong of Ex parte Young?
I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, is the nature of the 11th Amendment immunity itself. So as the Supreme Court discussed in Puerto Rico Aqueduct, 11th Amendment immunity provides immunity from suit, right? The whole purpose is to obviate the need for state officials to be dragged into federal court, right? And so the Ex parte Young analysis is really connected to that underlying concept, right? Why put state officials and states through the process if the injunctive relief is not available to begin with? And so I think it does implicate jurisdiction. It's not a merits question.
Well, isn't that a good argument that the Supreme Court made a mistake in 1908 when they issued Ex parte Young? What is there in Ex parte Young that allows for a gloss saying, well, you satisfy the first prong of Ex parte Young if you are seeking prospective injunctive relief for an ongoing violation of federal law, unless the claim itself triggers the underlying concept for the basis for the 11th Amendment as an immunity from suit.
I think in order to answer that question, we need to go back and see what Ex parte Young is based upon. And it really was an effort of the Supreme Court to harmonize the 11th Amendment with the other rights secured by the Constitution, right? It's supposed to vindicate federal rights, right? But Ex parte Young does not expand the scope of the underlying constitutional right itself, right? So that's why I started out talking about Fifth Amendment doctrine itself, because it's been clear for over 130 years that the Takings Clause, which by the way is also called the Just Compensation Clause, is really designed to provide for compensation. And if a party can get compensation, that is their remedy for a violation of the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause. So, that's why this implicates Ex parte Young and why simply asking for an injunction it does not allow the courtroom doors to be flown open. That has never been the case in the Ex parte doctrine, especially in the Fifth Amendment context. You look at cases like Pennhurst, you look at cases like Edelman, even this court's decision in Williams, you actually look at what they're requesting, and if that doesn't match up with what they're entitled to, sovereign immunity applies.
Well, of those three cases, the only one that involved Ex parte Young was Judge Baldock's opinion in Williams. And why isn't your theory incompatible with the opinion in Williams, which specifically addressed Mr. Haddock's role as the government official, and he was the only one that invoked Ex parte Young in Williams, and it specifically differentiated Mr. Haddock's role from all of the other UDOC defendants in Williams. So why doesn't Williams cut against you?
I think Williams supports me because that is the position or the approach that I'm asking the court to take here, which is you have to look at what injunctive relief is being requested to see whether or not it matches with the Ex parte Young exception, right? And that is where I think the Ex parte analysis for the district court's Ex parte analysis and Teva's argument really falls apart here, is because they really can't dispute that they're only entitled to just compensation under the takings clause. And so the glaring mismatch between what they're entitled to for the purported constitutional violation and what they're requesting, it just does not further Ex parte Young, and I don't think other courts that have squarely addressed this issue have come out the way that I'm suggesting, which is, listen, the remedy you're asking for is not available under your theory, so we have to dismiss this case under sovereign immunity principles.
What if we determine that the remedy available under Colorado law was inadequate? I mean, then it's okay, isn't it, to grant prospective relief? Because you don't just have to provide just compensation. I mean, it has to be an adequate remedy.
Correct.
Right. So if there's a determination that the remedy is inadequate, or an allegation that the remedy is inadequate, then that's a merits question.
No, it's not, Your Honor. I think that, again, that is a 11th Amendment upfront question.
So in your opinion, the we sort of have a mixture of the merits and the 11th Amendment question to determine that we have to consider the merits at least to some degree in order to determine whether there's 11th Amendment immunity.
Not quite, Your Honor. It's what I'm saying is that whether or not there's an adequate remedy, state court remedy available, that's a purely legal question that the court can look at and decide. It's not really a merits determination. And I think the other courts that have sort of approached this and, you know, squarely addressed this issue that we're talking about today have approached it in that way. They have
tell me what the remedy is. I mean, do better too than just saying, well, they're entitled to just compensation, because that's amorphous. I mean, is the remedy they can file 14,000 lawsuits a year? Is that their remedy?
No.
Is their remedy that they can bundle them up and file a big lawsuit every 2 years?
So their litigation strategy, I'll leave it up to Teva's counsel to determine that. But their actual remedy is, under Colorado law, they have a cause of action to get a just compensation for a violation of the takings clause of the Colorado Constitution and the federal constitution. So that is open to them in federal court. They can get just compensation, which is the fair market value for every EpiPen that supposedly is taken in the process, right? But that's not all, right? Just like every other lawsuit in Colorado, the prevailing party is entitled to litigation costs and fees. So they'd get that there. And just like with every other constitutional violation case in Colorado court, if the plaintiff prevails, they're entitled to attorney's fees, right? So all the remedies that are available to them: just compensation, fair market value, litigation costs, attorney fees. Oh, and I forgot, prejudgment interest, right? So, and this is why I think this whole notion of an infinite number of suits is practically not the case, right?
Well, it does. I mean, it does make it different than most takings cases that you look at in the reported decisions.
Right, because, you know, typically when we're talking about takings, you know, especially in the state court context, we're talking about eminent domain, inverse condemnation, real property cases. But I think, you know, if you look at the Horn decision from this Colorado Supreme, or not Colorado, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think the message.
Which decision was that? I didn't hear you.
Horn.
Horn.
Horn. H-O-R-N-E. Okay. It's about the raise and set asides.
Yep.
You know, I think the underlying message there is that there's really not a difference between real property and personal property when we're talking about takings, right? It's sort of analyzed under the same concepts. And so the fact that we're talking about epinephrine auto injectors and not, you know, a piece, an acre of property. It doesn't really matter. It's never sort of been a distinction within our jurisprudence, and I don't think this court should start adopting that distinction now.
Isn't an adequate remedy a conclusion to the matter once and for all?
No. So, again, we're talking about federal court jurisdiction here. So if they have an adequate remedy in Colorado State Court, this case should end here in federal court. And if Teva chooses, they should go to Colorado State Court, and there we can really litigate whether or not there's a taking, and if there's a taking, what's just compensation for that taking.
I'm talking about this case. In other words, if the remedy isn't adequate, it's not an adequate remedy. And conclusion or finality is always a part, usually, of what an adequate remedy is, isn't it?
Not in the Fifth Amendment takings context, Your Honor. I think that's never been the case. You know, repeatedly over the years, the Supreme Court has basically said, you know, you get just compensation for the taking. And if you get just compensation, then injunctive relief
is... Yeah, well, what's happening here is you're saying that the adequate remedy is the fact that they can, each time that this occurs, they can bring a lawsuit in Colorado and argue that we need to be paid for that. That's not a conclusion to the matter. You just dumped it all over on them, but they still have to comply with the taking.
Right, because I think it goes back to the Fifth Amendment's guarantees, which is the right to just compensation.
I know where it goes back to. I'm just saying an adequate remedy to me, if I personally was looking at it, would be a finality to the, you know, put an end to the litigation.
So, okay. So that goes to my preclusion argument, Your Honor. Because these are identical products and an identical law, one lawsuit would be all that would be necessary, really, to decide these issues, right?
No, you say right. I don't necessarily agree with that.
I contend, Your Honor, you're correct. I contend that really one is, you know, given issue preclusion principles, claim preclusion principles, it would provide a degree of finality. So the notion that they'd have to file 14,000 lawsuits just really isn't the case. I'd like to turn.
It would be their burden every time they filed a suit to prove, even if they could use offensive collateral estoppel or offensive claim issue preclusion to prove that the taking had occurred, it would be their burden to establish how many EpiPens were taken, or as I've been advised by my law clerks, epinephrine auto-injectors were taken in each suit. And so they do have some litigation burden in every case, and presumably the state could say, oh no, we disagree, you know, you're 8 pins over, it was only 64 injectors.
So in terms of the tracking point, Your Honor, this is a sophisticated pharmaceutical company that presumably tracks their products. So that's, you know, sure, there'd be some tracking involved, but that really wouldn't be an onerous burden, right? And so that there's that piece. And then there's also the piece of, you know, if they prevail in Colorado State Court and they get the issue preclusion that they want, all they'd have to do is file a case, say, this has already been decided, here's all the pens we've given, there's our evidence, and it would really be difficult for the state to really contest that at that point. So given issue preclusion, this concept of multiplicity of suit is just practically not correct. And I think it's never really been in our jurisprudence. I see my time is about to expire. I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, we'll stop the clock at 45, but I do want my colleagues to be able to ask.
No, I don't have anything else. Thank you.
I'm all right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Leo for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Jay Lefkowitz on behalf of the appellants. Much of what my colleague has argued goes to the ultimate merits. Is there an adequate remedy? And I do want to answer Judge Carson's question before I sit down about the burden. But I think it's important to start with the premise that, as the Supreme Court made clear in Verizon, as this court reiterated in Fowler, as the court reiterated just this past week in the Guy Clark, Deb Haaland case, the standard under the Verizon case by the Supreme Court is, does the party seeking relief seek prospective injunctive relief to prevent an ongoing harm? And that is the threshold question. And I recognize that in the event that the party opposing it says, well, it's a frivolous claim, there is some case law, even Verizon mentions that, but no one is suggesting that our claim is frivolous. And in fact, the trial judge has said we may well be entitled to an injunction. He wants to look at this when it comes back to him, but he says, based on the multiplicity of suits here, we may well not have an adequate remedy. And he also has said conclusively on page 14, what the state is doing with the EpiPen is a taking. So I think the question on this narrow appeal, which is an 11th Amendment immunity appeal, the state has not sought or received, you know, 1292 certification to appeal the 12b6 ruling. The question is simply, have we stated a claim that would survive the ex parte Young exception? And I think it absolutely would. There's no question here, as in the case we listened to earlier this morning, that the Attorney General is the proper party in this case to sue. The only question is, what is the relief that we are seeking? It's clearly not frivolous. Now, I do think, going beyond just that narrow question, which I think is sufficient to decide the appeal here, if the court were even to reach this question, I do think it should hold that equitable relief is available to avoid an endless series of damages here. And what the Nick case makes clear is, in the normal takings case, injunctive relief probably won't be available, because when you're dealing with one act of the government that takes your property, that violates your rights to get access to something, it's a one-time event. And so you can look and assess what the compensation would be. This is the very unusual situation where what the government is authorizing is an endless stream of takings, per se takings. And it doesn't matter, frankly, as the Kuntz court said, it doesn't matter whether they're taking our actual physical property or offering us the alternative of paying for it. The reality is we are losing our property, and we would be required to undergo a multiplicity of suits, which is a basic standard under equity law for having a non-adequate or an inadequate remedy. And to answer Judge Carson's...
Is there an inherent tension in the claim, in the fact, in the sense that the statute went into effect on January 1st, 2024, and when you sought this prospective injunctive relief, the statute, as I understand it, had not gone into effect. And yet the second prong of Ex parte Young is to enjoin an ongoing violation of federal law. And so you're making the point now, I think, well stated, that you're seeking prospective injunctive relief rather than retroactive injunctive relief that might accompany a more conventional taking claim. But then again, when you sought the injunction, there had been no taking yet.
Correct, but what we were seeking at the time, and the court addressed the questions of standing and rightness in the context of imminent constitutional violations, we were seeking to actually enjoin what was a certainty, what was going to happen under this statute, and there was never any, as the court recognized below, never any disclaimer of its intent to enforce the statute. Now, in fairness, the trial judge denied our request for preliminary injunction, said during the course of this litigation, I don't think you'll suffer irreparable harm because I'll be there to address it and you can seek permanent injunctive relief, which is frankly what we intend to do on remand. But I want to just address briefly Judge Carson's specific question about the burden. You know, it isn't just, Your Honor, the question of whether it's 15 EpiPens or 20 EpiPens, whether it's 100 or 300. We also have the question, we're entitled to fair market value. And the way that that drug manufacturers sell, they don't sell directly to the pharmacies. They sell to wholesalers.
under complicated discount arrangements that are volume-based and perhaps even time-based. And so we would technically be entitled to our just compensation for the EpiPens that were delivered in January, and then in February, and then in March, and they might have different prices attached to them.
Can I find this in the record? Is this going to be in the record if I?
It will. It's not in the record yet. This is what would be developed on remand. Your
okay.
Our argument was simply, and I was just answering your
right.
question.
No, fair
our
enough.
Our argument is simply, even just looking at the statute, we would be required to have a multiplicity of suits. And frankly, under Nick, where the Supreme Court said the constitutional violation takes place at the moment of the taking, we wouldn't even be required to wait till the end of the 2-year statute of limitations period. We technically would be entitled, if we wanted, I'm not sure we would, to file a lawsuit every single time we got a new EpiPen request from a pharmacy.
So why in light of the fact that you can recover your costs and you can recover your attorney's fees, why is that an inadequate remedy, even if you have to file 14,000 of them a year?
The Supreme Court has made very clear, going all the way back to Terrence versus Thompson, that a damages remedy is only adequate if it is as complete, practical, and efficient as that which equity could afford. And as Wright and Miller makes very clear, equity relief should be available when effective legal relief can only be secured by a multiplicity of actions. This is the paradigmatic case for that. That's certainly what the Eighth Circuit found on almost an identical statute. I mean, it related to insulin instead of epinephrine injectors, but it was essentially the identical statute. And they found that a damages remedy was not adequate. In a somewhat similar but not identical context, a plurality of the Supreme Court in Eastern Association versus Apfel recognized that if all that's happening is you're seeking compensation and then getting it paid directly back and you're creating essentially a revolving door with the government, it can't possibly be that that's what the purpose of the statute was, because after all, the government could just buy the EpiPens directly from the manufacturers and distribute them to people in Colorado if they wanted. So I do think, but again, Your Honor, I just want to say, going back to Judge Bachrach's very first question to the state, we are really talking now about prong two of the analysis, which, as this court and as the Supreme Court has said, is not really the appropriate question to ask as long as we're not dealing with a frivolous complaint. And this is clearly a complaint that is asking to enjoin prospective ongoing relief. We are now suffering that harm at this stage in the case. And I think the Williams case is really as directly on point as you can have. In the first part of that case, what the court made very clear was this was a case claiming the failure, you know, to pay interest on the prison or inmate accounts, and it says they failed to pay the interest. And the whole first part of that decision goes through and says, look, for a damages remedy, state court is open to you. And they cite a Utah statute and a Utah case and said, so there's no question that a just compensation remedy is available. But then the second part of that opinion, which would not have even been necessary to write, but for the principle I'm arguing for here, says, but Mr. Williams asserts that 11th Amendment immunity doesn't apply to his claim against Haddon, who was one of the Department of Correctional Officials, the executive director. Why? Because an exception exists for prospective injunctive relief. And then Judge Baldock goes through very carefully and says, but here the complaint doesn't allege any prison official should be enjoined from a future violation. That entire analysis wouldn't have been necessary if the state's argument is correct.
Well, in Williams, the plaintiff didn't argue that any of the other defendants other than Mr. Haddock were entitled to invoke Ex parte Young. So I'm not sure the last part of what you just said is correct.
Well, I guess my point is, first of all, this court on many, many occasions addresses the Ex parte Young issue sua sponte because it's jurisdictional. And my point is the Williams court had no problem disposing of the claim against the government officials when it was a claim for just for damages.
Ex parte Young creates jurisdiction. We have no obligation to sua sponte divine bases to acquire jurisdiction. We have a sua sponte basis to make sure that jurisdiction hasn't been improperly exercised.
That's true. I guess the state could waive their immunity if they wanted to. But my only point is, in the Williams case, the whole discussion of Ex parte Young and the exception for prospective injunctive relief wouldn't have even been relevant since there wasn't a claim for injunctive relief there. The court simply made the point, I believe, to recognize that there are two different types of takings claims. There are takings claims, and most of the cases that the state cites, there's a case from the Sixth Circuit that the state cites called Laborers International. There's a Tenth Circuit case, EEE Minerals. There's an Eighth Circuit case, Long versus Bureau of Reclamation. Every one of those cases was a case where what the court was saying is, yes, they say it's a claim for injunctive relief, but it's really just disguised as a claim for damages. You know, I want injunctive relief to pay me the fair market value of my property. And when you have something that on the face of the complaint you can look at and say is not actually a claim for prospective injunctive relief, then I think as a matter of law, the court could say it doesn't qualify under Ex parte Young's exception. But again, that's not the situation here at all. We have a very clean complaint. We have a determination by the trial judge that we may in fact be entitled to injunctive relief, but he's denied it. And the only issue that the state has appealed on is the question of 11th Amendment immunity. We know under Nick that an inadequate remedy would still potentially give rise to injunctive relief. It may be the rare case. We may or may not ultimately prevail. But the question for this court, and I don't think the court could have made it any more clear than it did in Fowler versus Stitt, is we look at the claim as raised. It's a straightforward analysis under Verizon, and we do not engage in an analysis of the merits of the claim.
I want to make sure that I heard something you said earlier correctly. On the adequacy of the state court remedy, I thought I had heard you say that that's the second prong of Ex parte Young.
No, it's not the second.
That's an element of getting an injunction.
It's the second prong of this lawsuit.
Okay.
That's what this lawsuit will ultimately be about.
All right.
Yes. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to rest on the argument in the briefs.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to go back to the multiplicity of suit point and just to emphasize is truly how unprecedented this argument is. I have been unable to find this argument adopted in any Fifth Amendment case ever. And I think that really demonstrates just how far afield this concept is from our Fifth Amendment Takings Clause jurisprudence. Colorado General Assembly adopted this policy to address a pressing public health problem. Teva disagrees with the approach, says that they should have taken a different approach, but it's fine. It was the Colorado General Assembly's prerogative to do what it did, right? As long as Teva has just compensation remedies in state courts, that's all that's really necessary. The court should not expand federal jurisdiction in the way that the district court has. I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. This matter will be submitted. Thank you, to counsel from both sides for your excellent, written and oral advocacy. It will go to